I'm Carol Kenner and I'm interviewing Stephen Pusey by Skype. And Stephen, could you tell me your name and give me the spelling?
Yes, it's Stephen Pusey. It's the last name is pronounced as if it has a Z in it. The spelling there is S-T-E-P-H-E-N, and my last name is spelt P-U-S-E-Y.
And Stephen, can you tell me when you were born and where you are living now?
I was born in Clapham, London, the UK, southwest London, and I am now living in New York City in America, in the United States.
That's quite a big leap. Why did you move to New York?
In 1986, I was invited to show at PS1, which is now PS1 MoMA. And I came here, I thought the show was for 3 weeks, and then the show ran for 3 months. That was, I think, from through the fall of 86. And then Edward Fry, who was still alive at the time, was the creator of Documenta, wanted to get the work into Documenta. So I stayed longer to meet the curators from Documenta. And that didn't work out. The work was about the Holocaust, and it was a little too much for them, I think. But it led to me staying longer in the US. And I burnt some bridges, as I was wont to do in those days in London. And a lot of things I'd been doing. I'd also curated a show in New York at another exhibition space called PS122 with some artists from London. And I had to stay on for that. And it just went on from there. I just kept staying longer and longer, and eventually I was out of status. And then I met my wife here, and we were both out of status. And then I won the lottery for a green card. It was the Morrison visa, which was geared to the Irish in those days, and I'm also an Irish citizen. So I won that, and I became legalized and ended up being here. And sometimes I wonder why, but anyway.
Well, can we go back to your roots then, and or your beginnings? You were born in Clapham. Can you tell us something about your childhood and your parents?
Yes, I don't remember much about Clapham. My parents moved to Brixton when I was very young, to the top of Brixton Hill. It was what we call over in the United States Project Housing. It was a block of council flats, I guess, which had no bathrooms. It was right next to Brixton Prison. And many of the inhabitants of the building had their fathers in Brixton Prison. it was fairly rough. As I said, there were no baths. The working class didn't deserve baths in those days. So my mother had a tin bath that she would bring out once a week. She would boil up the water on the stove, and I and my siblings would bathe in it. I think we'd all bathe in it. That was in the 50s, and then my mother got us out of there, and we moved to the Abbeywood Estate, and that was, I think, in 1960, and that was the first time we had a house with a garden, and it was great. It was also interesting, later on I studied sociology, and It made me realize what it was all about in a way. There was an exodus from London slums in the 60s, as they were being erased in the east end of London, and also places renovated like in the southwest of London. And so all these, we were always a nuclear family, more or less, but the families from the east end of London all ended up mostly in Abbeywood Estate and satellite estates like that, on the borders of Kent and London. And they became nuclearized families, and prior to that they lived in areas where there were they belonged to extended family networks, you know, where aunts and uncles would live next door and people would be popping in and out of each houses for tea and milk and sugar and whatever. So that led to a growth of gangs, you know, and I was a member of a gang on my estate. And I'd be running around with boys my age and older. I had a lot of freedom. I don't think my parents realized what I was up to half the time. I could get out to the woods very easily in Abbey Woods. You know, that was a few miles walk, and I had a dog, and we'd go off there. He'd be off the leash. It was pretty wild. And we'd wander through the woods by ourselves and come back, and then I'd be going through the marshes while Thamesmead was being built. As you know, Stanley Kubrick, Clockwork Orange, based Clockwork Orange on Thamesmead, but actually Abbeywood preceded it, it was very much, Clockwork Orange is a bit like Abbeywood Estate as well. And we would run through the marshes and looking for mischief and taking building materials and reconstructing kind of temporary habitats out of them where we'd hang out. We were very creative and inventive, but delinquent. And we'd run along sewer bank. I think we hitchhike this diesel train, I think it was, or a shunt train, on the sewer bank, and we drove it along the sewer bank for some miles before we were stopped by police and then chased along the marshes with the police and dogs on the leash. And I barely made it back to our house on the estate, and I ducked underneath the kitchen window. My mother was pretty innocent, you know, wondered what I was doing. I was watching the police knock on the doors of every house. And fortunately, they didn't come to mine. Eventually, we moved from there. My parents managed to buy a house in Erith in Kent. That, I guess, was a sort of lower middle class area. It was up in the hill. It was very pleasant, and they lived there until they died. And that really became our place, you know, in Kent. If I stayed on the estate, there's no doubt that my delinquent and creative intelligence would have been put to a more criminal use. And I may have ended up in some of the borstal homes as some of my associates did on the estate at the time. My parents were both immigrants to the country. My mother came from Ireland and my father came from India. His family had been out there for generations. Goes back a couple of hundred years, I think, to the early 1800s. They were, I guess, in administration, you know, sort of clerical stuff and military and whatever. My father was in the security forces in India. And then he came, I think, to England in 42. Things had started to get rough in India. He was a young man, you know, seeking a new life. And then eventually his parents, I think, followed him in, like, 45. Or a bit later, actually. I'm not quite sure when they came over. I guess my parents met in the early 50s, and can't remember exactly when they were married, 51 or something like that. I was born in 52. And I have four sisters who are younger than me.
It sounds very exotic, household, India and Ireland. Did that come across in the house, or the way you lived, the, you know, the type of food you ate or things like that?
My father had, put it mildly, a low opinion of Indians. He was of that ilk, unfortunately, and we had a lot of conflict in that regard. But he was a good person. He was an extremely hard worker. He was creative. He was a photographer, an amateur photographer, and he won awards for his photography, but he really had to concentrate on making a living and keeping the household together of five children. My mother was very well read, and she was a bit of a dreamer and imaginative person, but she was very pragmatic as well. This is a kind of Irish combination, you know. Are you from Irish stock? Are you Kenner?
I am, yes. My father was Irish.
Yes, we're everywhere. And actually, I discovered, you know, because one of my cousins does a lot of ancestry research, etc., that, especially on my father's side, that there was a lot of Irish, actually, on my father's side as well, that I didn't know about, which is interesting. So they were very different personalities. They were both the same age, my mother and father, and were born in the same year in 1922. As I said, she was Irish and came to Ireland after the collapse of her family's business in Ballinagh. Some of her siblings went to Dublin, and some of them went to other parts of Ireland, and some of them came to London. And when my father met, you know, it was a struggle to make ends meet. He was doing clerical work, and she was keeping the home. But they were poor, and there were rack rents, and so they eventually moved into this place called Brixton Buildings, which when I last went there, they'd renovated and they put in bathrooms. And it was called Rentfield Close or something strange like this. Very pretentious. But in those days, if you said you came from Brixton Buildings, people didn't want to talk to you. They would look askance at you, like you're from those buildings.
Close their purses and...
Yes, yeah. So we moved out there to Abbeywood eventually, and I had failed the 11 plus. I'm extremely myopic. Without contact lenses or glasses, I'm totally blind. Kind of contradiction for an artist, but it's interesting because, you know, it always led me to question things I was seeing and looking at. This kind of contradiction between, you know, being able to see and not being able to see, and was always interesting to me. So I failed 11 plus and I went to a secondary modern school, the Catholic secondary modern school, which was a row of wooden huts, built as a temporary measure before the war. It was called St. Stephen's in Welling, Kent. And we were destined to, I guess, you know, leave and go and work in factories at the age of 16 until the headmaster, who was a kind of very stern Jesuit, left, thank goodness, and was replaced by this fiery Irishman. He had like wild red hair that went off in every direction. He wasn't very tall, and the boys all made fun of him. But he basically saved the lives of a number of us. We called him Tatty because of his hairstyle. Trying to remember his name now, but he was wonderful, and he was a sociologist, and he made it so that a number of us could actually stay on and do A-levels. And but before that, you know, we had teachers who would sit in the classroom and read from books, and not really teach at all, you know, and even smoke their pipes in the classroom. and then that changed, you know, when he arrived. It started to change. So he pooled resources with a local girls' school, and we were able to share teachers and go on for further studies. I think I got 4 A-levels. One of them was sociology, economic history, and art. So I got a grade A in art. He wanted me to go to the University of London, study sociology. And my parents thought that was a good idea as well. that, you know, I would be a teacher and or something like that, and I would earn money, a decent living. I said, no, I want to be an artist. And I insisted on it. And they thought I was crazy, and they warned me. And, you know, they were right. It's very difficult. I don't advise anybody to become an artist or anybody to come to New York City. It's a very difficult life. It has its rewards. And, you know, if you have to do it, you have to do it, I guess. There's nothing else that will stop you. But, yes, I tell anybody who thinks that being an artist is a good idea, do a business course first or something like that. Anyway, meander.
Let me take you back a moment to your parents and your grandparents. You touched on your political differences with your father in particular, I think. Is that right? Or you were coming at life from a different angle?
Yes, I mean, he was rooted in a different culture, you know, the British in India, and the contradiction is that he loved Indian food, you know. I mean, any poor household in India could afford to have an Indian servant, you know, or cook, you know, who'd cook up the food. So he did love certain aspects about India, but they didn't have a high regard for the ordinary population of India. They kept themselves to themselves, you know. And I think there were contradictions to that, you know. My attitude was very different. You know, I had a lot of friends of different races. From an early age, I thought it was very important for people to recognize each other as, you know, equals and as human beings, you know. We had conflicts on that subject, yeah. But I realized he was never really going to change very much. But he, you know, my wife is Korean, and my parents were both very accepting of her. So there, you know, there are contradictions.
Yeah. And did you know your grandparents well?
Yes, I knew them. I knew my maternal grandmother. She came over from Ireland to stay with us in her later years. And she was sort of like, she was very aristocratic. It's very interesting. And all the children on the Abbeywood estate loved her. She would walk around and she'd be followed by children. My paternal grandparents died, I guess, when I was about 8 or something like that. And they were very loving. I was very close to them. Would spend some time with them.
Did they live close by?
They lived, originally they lived in a prefab, which when they first came to the country, I can't remember exactly where that was. It wasn't that far away. And then they moved to Tulse Hill with my father's brother, my uncle, where they lived basically until the end of their life. And they both died, I think. I'm not quite sure, but I think my grandfather was only 60 when he died. But he looked a lot older than I do now. It's funny, you know. Maybe it was the diet in India. And looking back through the ancestry, you know, my father died when he was 89. My mother died when she was 84. My paternal grandfather, I said, died when he was 60. His father died in his 40s. And before that, they died in their 40s too. They all died young in India.
It's worth moving here then.
I think, you know, post-war, you know, everything has changed in terms of, you know, the kinds of foods we get from different countries and our diet, etc., and healthcare and attitude towards living, you know. I think everybody smoked in those days. I guess you remember the 50s, perhaps. I'm not sure how young you are, but But everybody smoked. I smoked, quite heavily at one time, and gave up in 1980, threw that back as far as I could. And if I hadn't, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today. I swim most days of the week, cycle on distances, up the Hudson. So we have a different attitude, I think, towards our health. I don't know how long I'm going to live. I might die tomorrow. Who knows?
Hope not. So you went to secondary modern school. Where did you go after that? You got A-levels?
Yeah, I got A-levels, and then I applied to only one art school. I was pretty sure of myself. And I applied to St. Martin's School of Art, and no other secondary choice, which was kind of silly. And I went there, and fortunately for me, they accepted me. And then after the foundation, they accepted me for the degree course as well. So I did, 4 years there altogether. The work before I'd gone to college, my work at school had gone through everything from abstraction to surrealism. I became very interested in surrealism. Before I could paint, I could write, and I always wrote imaginatively. It was the only way that my teachers could discern that I had any intelligence, any iota of intelligence, was through my writing, because I was useless to everything else. And then somewhere along the line, I think at the age of 16, I discovered that I could draw and paint. And that developed very, very fast. Within a year or two, I'd gone in leaps and bounds, and I spent most of my time in the art room. Fortunately, the teacher there, Robert Salmon, his name was, he was an artist too, was very indulgent of me, and let me have the run of the art room. Even borrowed, he had a skull, a real skull, not a plastic one, in a box in the cupboard there.
So you were telling me that you were living with some Brazilians and that you got interested in what was happening in Chile in about 1973.
Yeah. My interest in Chile preceded that. But they were working at the International Coffee Organization, and they would be getting a bulletin of unfiltered news that went out to the shareholders and the people who worked at the International Coffee Organization in London. And they would bring that home for me because of my interest in what was going on there. And I would see that it would be a day-by-day account of what was happening. And I would see that there was a complete contradiction between what they were reporting and what was being reported in the London press at the time. Basically, very little was being reported in the London press, because I think of shareholder interests in Chile. Even the Guardian newspaper had a very restricted reportage, and they must have known what was going on, because they probably had access to the same news information that I had access to through the ICO. That was part of my general politicization, but my politicization went right back to my childhood and my experience, on the estates, etc. I became a member of a group called Artists for Democracy. I was a founding member of that group with David Medalla, John Duggar, and other artists. Was it 73 or 74? I think it was 74. We put together, I didn't go to the Royal College. I think it was 74. We put together a huge exhibition at the Royal College in the Gulbenkian Hall in support of the identifiable resistance in Chile, which was the MIR, the Movimiento Escuela Revolucionaria, at the time. I was pretty naive, I guess. I did a huge painting of Salvador Allende and Pablo Neruda. It was very left fist stuff. We had this huge exhibition, Hockney, Oldenburg, Mata, whose work I'd seen when I was quite young, appeared there in person and finished a work in front of me. And he was like a sort of hero, you know, and I couldn't say boo to him because I was so in awe of him. I was 20-something at the time. It was a vast exhibition, a very professional, put together within 6 months by a bunch of artists, you know. There was an incredible energy to do things like that in those days. In the 80s, you know, everything became very institutionalized, and it was much more difficult to make things like that happen overnight. But we did it. It was extraordinary, and I reflect on it. The quality of work was amazing. And there was an auction that followed that, and I'm not quite sure where the money went. It may have gone to the MIR, it may have gone elsewhere, I don't know. I have no idea. And then after that, I left college. I had a studio before I left college in Covent Garden, and I was very involved with the Covent Garden community. Now, the Covent Garden community in the mid-70s was under threat because the government wanted to put a motorway down Long Acre, you know, divide up the community, do all kinds of things to it. And there were two types of communities in Covent Garden. There was the traditional community, the people who had worked in the market and businesses around the marketplace in Covent Garden. And they had been there for hundreds of years. It was father to son business. It was a conservative working class community, which is surprising, but they were conservative in general. And then the other community were all these students who had digs in the area, apartments in the area, who lived in short life housing, etc., as I did. They were from London School of Economics, the local art schools like St. Martin's, etc., and Chelsea. And architects, you know, from, and who eventually had businesses there too. And there was a lot of community and political activity set up by these yuppies, I guess. Like Street Aid, you know, which I was also involved with, run by David Beder. And there was a philanthropist, Christina Smith, who owned quite a lot of the warehouses in the area. She bought up area places behind the opera house, etc. And she actually eventually had an opera house, and she gave a substantial area to the Covent Garden community for a community center where I taught art at for a while.